From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama this week took new steps to close the gender gap in pay. Women have broken countless barriers. Take Oprah Winfrey, Sheryl Sandberg, Hillary Clinton, Justice Sotomayor. But hold on, our guests today say women's rise at work isn't as smooth as news reports would have you believe. The feel-good stories, they say, often drown out what's really taking place in the workplace. They call it a soft war against women. This hour on Point, how subtle forms of gender bias still hurt women in the workplace. You can join us on air or online. Do you see a soft war on women in your workplace, or are we all past that now? Joining me now in the studio are Carol Rivers, author, journalist, and professor of journalism at Boston University.
Right.
Hi.
Hi.
And Rosalind Barrett, clinical psychologist and senior scientist at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis University. Hello.
Hi.
So their new book is The New Soft War on Women, How the Myth of Female Ascendance is Hurting Women, Men, and Our Economy. You can read an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Carol, Rosalind, I'm glad you're here with us. We want to start right off with the title of your book, The New Soft War on Women. If I turn on TV, it sure looks like women are doing just fine getting ahead. What is the new research showing?
Well, what it's showing is that while women are doing great in academia, they're getting lots of degrees, they're doing very well, it's the absolute flip side in the workplace. They're stalling out. For example, women on boards have been stuck at 16% for 10 years. Women law partners have been stuck at 13%. So you look all across the board, and women are not only not soaring, they're slipping back. And that's a real story.
But I see Oprah Winfrey, Sheryl Sandberg at Facebook, not just Justice Sotomayor, but even Hillary Clinton. So we do see women who are breaking the glass ceiling. Are you saying that their advancement is masking troubles for other women?
Yeah, I think that they do get the headlines, and deservedly. I mean, they obviously made wonderful strides, but we're losing track of the fact that most women are not following their footsteps. In fact, we find that from first job out of school, women earn less than men, and that gap grows over time. So that take an MBA student, male and female, he'll come out of school earning $4,600 a year more than she will, and that gap just grows over time.
Let's stop right there. So you're saying from the get-go, a man of equal talent is earning more than a woman.
That's correct, and that's true even when you look at female-dominated occupations. So let's just say you talk about a male and female, both equally qualified, that go into social work or into teaching or into healthcare. Whatever the occupation, men earn more than women across the board.
Because a lot of people look at those stats, we all hear them, and say, yeah, that's because women end up taking time off to have a baby, or they have to have flex schedules after they have a family. And so those pay differences reflect women's different choices. It's not that they're being treated differently.
Well, even when you take those into account, there's still a substantial pay gap. And the thing is that even if the pay gap, say, narrows down to 20% instead of 70%, it goes over years and years and years. So women can wind up over years losing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousand dollars.
I want to get back to this a little later because the president pushed on this topic earlier this week. But let's stay broad for a moment. You explain that some of what you consider a soft war operates in, we could call it, underground ways. Some of the examples you give in your book, that you say women who do the lion's share of the work sometimes see the men on their teams get the credit, and men are promoted on potential, but women are judged for what they actually do. Can you break that down, explain to us further what's going on?
Sure. Let's take the first example. When you have mixed-sex teams, male and female, which is what's happening in a lot of workplaces, and women are encouraged, of course, to be part of those teams, when the outcome of the project is successful, say, it's much more likely that men are going to get credit for the work. They're seen as leaders. They're seen as competent. The women, even if they've done the lion's share of the work on the project, are often not given any credit at all. So it's very frustrating, women doing what they're told to do, you know, participating, but they're not getting the kind of credit they deserve. Moreover, it's women that are doing this as well as men. So in our culture, all of us, men and women alike, share this notion that men are competent, they're aggressive, they're ambitious. Women are not so much. They're not so competent, they're not so aggressive, they're more emotional. So that women don't get what they deserve.
We heard this all across the board. Women would say to us, you know, I did all the work on this project, then I went in to the board, and the board talked to the junior male member, didn't talk to me, and he got promoted and I didn't.
So I've seen this kind of dynamic in the workplace. One could push back and say, you know, sometimes women need to do a better job of chest thumping. It's on them to say, hey, look at my great work. And is this just about the way women should be behaving in the workplace needs to change? They need to lean in more?
Well they do. But then there's the issue of the B word, that when men are forceful and assertive, they are automatically likable. When women are forceful and assertive, they are called bees, right, and they're not liked by both men and women.
So the B word, you mean, we're not going to say the word, but mean, difficult, challenging, unlikable.
Yes.
Another part of that is that when in that discussion, the onus falls on women to do more, kind of explain themselves. And maybe women have to do some of that. But we should be having a broader discussion about the culture that encourages this in the first place, that women have to fight against. And that's partly an education process so that men and women know what they're doing so that they're obvious about it.
So I'd like to illustrate this a little bit, how women are seen in the workplace differently than the way men are seen, with a very high-profile example. Senior Senator Dianne Feinstein from California is the head of the powerful Senate Intelligence Committee. When the former CIA director Michael Hayden appeared on Fox News Sunday, he used an interesting word to describe Senator Feinstein and her new report criticizing Bush-era enhanced interrogation techniques. You'll hear him reference a column that appeared in the Washington Post. Take a listen.
He said that Senator Feinstein wanted a report so scathing that it would ensure that an un-American, brutal program of detention and interrogation would never again be considered or permitted. Now, that sentence, that motivation for the report, Chris, may show deep emotional feeling on the part of the senator, but I don't think it leads you to an objective report.
Deep emotional feeling on the part of the senator. So they're describing her experience with a very serious topic in terms of emotion. Okay, what's wrong with that?
You would never hear that said of a man. Would you say, John Kerry's just an emotional wreck? You know, I mean, that's the translation. You look at Wendy Davis running in Texas for governor. She was called a neglectful mother. Guess what? You know, her kids are 20 years old.
John McCain was called erratic.
Yes, one of the few who got, was considered what might be a woman's adjective, but it's not often used at men.
But the difference there is that when said about a woman, it fits into the stereotype. You say, oh, yeah, of course, that's what women are like. But you have an example like John McCain, it's counter-stereotypical, so you don't count it. You kind of brush that off and the stereotype stands in place.
So will you tease it out? In what ways does the view of women as over-emotional keep them back at work?
Makes them, first of all, maybe hesitant to take strong stands because no one wants to be seen as out of control. It makes them have to explain, for example, an extra burden when, let's say, they lose patience at work. When a man loses patience at work, it seems part of what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to be, you know, strong and take stands. If a woman does that, she's going to get slammed unless she explains why she got angry in the first place.
And if you're too emotional, you can't lead. You can't make the tough decisions. On the other hand, if you're too tough, you know, you're the bee, and you probably can't lead either. So women get caught in that bind.
I think there'll be people listening to this who will believe you see these kinds of problems if you're looking for them. But is there really data to back it up?
Yes, definitely. Our book is based on a review of a lot of research in social psychology, where almost everything we said in there has some citation. So we didn't just kind of sit around and think about this and write it up, but we actually relied on what's in the empirical literature.
Do women get more blame than men for failures?
Yes. One of the things we find that women don't get second chances. For example, the Athena project on tech. The man tries to make the diving catch and be a hero. He fails. His buddies dust him off. The woman tries something risky and she's gone. So it makes her sometimes a little, you know, gun shy.
It gets back to a point you made earlier, which is that men are promoted on potential, women are promoted on performance. So if he fails, they say, well, he's really a leader. He's got the right stuff. Maybe he screwed up this time. Maybe he didn't get the thing done. But he's got the potential. We're going to just let him try again. If she's being promoted on performance, then she's only as good as her last performance.
And McKinsey says that often, not only don't the women know this is happening, the people who are doing the hiring don't know this is happening. So the woman in in question over years and years and years and years keeps falling further behind.
You're saying it's sort of like a frog in boiling water. It's so prevalent, you stop noticing it or don't realize it's happening.
Exactly.
I'd like to hear from a person who may have experienced this firsthand. Sally Krawcheck was a former banking executive, and she spoke to NPR's Morning Edition Monday about her time as CEO of Citigroup's Smith Barney unit when Smith Barney lost a significant amount of investor money.
I took the stance, for which I lost my job, that we should partially reimburse our clients, and had a fight within the organization for it. We eventually did partially reimburse our clients, but I was stripped of my responsibility. If you'd asked me at that point in time, Sally, did you get fired because you're a woman? I would have said, what are you kidding me? Absolutely not. And as I've started to say, my thinking in reviewing the research now is, well, maybe. You know, the research tells me these are characteristics and qualities that a woman exhibits, and I was fired for it.
So she didn't even notice it or see it in a gendered way at first. Is that typical?
Very common that women don't realize it until, as Sally Krawcheck did, they look back later or they start reading something, they say, hey, that is what happened to me. Why didn't I see it at the time?
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about women in the workplace and what's keeping most of them from the top jobs. And we're talking with Carol Rivers and Rosalind Barnett, co-authors of the new Soft War on Women, How the Myth of Female Ascendance is Hurting Women, Men, and Our Economy. Ladies, I'd love to start with a comment from somebody on our website. Bill98 writes, funny how the guests mention how well women are doing in education, where they comprise 60% of undergraduates, and yet they don't see this as a problem for men. When women were underrepresented in college, we were told it was a crisis, but when men are underrepresented, we're supposed to see it as a triumph. Is it true that women's advances are now leaving men behind?
Not really. When you analyze the statistics, what you find is when you look at the typical college population, and that's white students around 17, 18, the gap is only 3 percentage points.
Meaning 3% more women.
Yes. And the reason that you see so many more women is a huge influx of older women, huge influx of minority women. But, you know, it's argued that they're all going to take over the top jobs in the Western world. But, you know, are people who are majoring in sociology or who are 45 years old really going to be the Secretary of State?
Also, there's another point. The fact is that we're talking about percents as opposed to absolute numbers. In absolute numbers, there are more men and women going to college now than ever before. So the fact that more women are going doesn't mean that men are somehow suffering. Men's advancement in college is also growing, but at a slower rate.
So what do you say to people who are concerned that men are suffering too, and that this focus on women is really sort of blanketing their challenges and minimizing what men face in a difficult workplace?
Well, nobody's doing really well in this workplace, and men are suffering, but they have a big stake in women doing well, because in most couples stay in the middle class because they have two incomes. So, you know, I think men are realizing that it's good for them.
Let me bring in now somebody who's going to join us on the phone. Amalia Miller is here with us. Amalia is in Vienna, Virginia. She's professor of economics at University of Virginia, and her research has focused on women in the workplace. Welcome, Amalia.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So why don't you add a little more data to some of this discussion? We've heard a lot so far, but there's some discussion online about whether we're just cherry-picking data, ignoring inconvenient facts to, quote, feign outrage. That's what one person wrote in on the website. So let's start with equal pay. What do you see there?
Sure. So I would just say that I found the book really engaging and the conversation so far really interesting. And I think that I, in looking at the aggregate data in the U.S., would tend to agree with sort of the main, what I see as the main argument of the book, which is that women have not achieved full economic equality with men. And that's something you can see if we look at things like pay equality or the pay gap. It is the case that that if you adjust for full time, if you look at workers who are full time, full year workers, that women are earning, you know, about 77 cents on the dollar at the median, and it's a little bit less if you look at the mean. Now, in terms of that's the status quo. I think in terms of the history, I think that there has been substantial progress over the past several decades, over the past 50 years. And I think where I might disagree a little bit with the emphasis of the book is that I don't think that that looking at that progress and celebrating it is a bad thing. I don't think that it has to distract from our focus of looking at the current lack of parity. And I also think that it's actually really helpful in figuring out what are the changes that happened over the past 50 years that enabled this progress so that we can figure out what's going to be necessary to either preserve it and make sure that the gains don't erode, or to try to make additional gains in the future.
It's an interesting point, Carol. Are there lessons learned from the ways women have advanced so far that can be applied to the future?
Sure, there are, but there's a really interesting study that shows when women look at these stories about, oh, we're doing great, we're making all these gains, they put on rose-colored glasses that they say, you know, there's no problem anymore, don't need feminism anymore, and that sometimes leads them to say, well, in my workplace, I'm not doing great, so I've got to go get another degree, and not to say, look at the entire structure, but we sure can learn from the past.
Rosalind, may I ask, and then you can make your point, which is, even in the White House, the president this week announced that he is going to sign documents extending equal pay, more equal pay rights to more women in federal government. But then when you look at the data inside the White House, women in the White House on average earn less than men. And yet, at the highest levels, the highest paid White House women earn more than the highest paid White House men. So is this a case where we can find whatever we're looking for and you guys are just looking for data that makes women look like victims?
Okay, a number of points to make here. For one thing, I agree with Malia, but I disagree also. Our book hopefully messages that women have made gains. There are obviously problems, but we're not there. We have a way to go. So women need to understand where we've been, and then to say we have to not just sort of rest on our laurels, but we have to continue fighting for equality. And I think that the idea that we're cherry picking, I think that's not accurate. If you look at all the data, and we have looked at a lot, and Maya has as well, it tells a pretty consistent picture.
Amalia, let's listen to a caller, and I'll ask you to discuss it. This is Sharon from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Jessica. I am an attorney with a major Boston bank, and I just want to say that the situation for women, particularly in the financial services, is far worse even than your guests are describing. It is very typical to see the important jobs at a bank go to men, and senior women are in staff positions. They're not in business development positions. Additionally, we have a joke at my bank. When I'm leaving for the day, typically at 7:30, 8 o'clock, the people who are leaving with me are women. And it's always kind of a joke that we're the 70 cents on the dollar set. We're too stupid to be leaving when the men are leaving because it's only women leaving late.
Women leaving late. All right.
So hard.
Got it. Thank you for your for sharing your experience, Sharon. I know a lot of women feel the same way. Amalia, let me ask you, are women making choices that are keeping them back?
Yeah, I think that is one of the key questions, one of the central questions that is very hard from the data, just looking at outcomes, to disentangle. So is it that women are not achieving the same types of success, the same types of leadership positions because they're not trying or they don't want to, or they're not able, which is kind of one category of story. And then the other story is that there are barriers that they're facing, challenges, sort of extra burdens they're carrying as women. And I think that the caller, Sharon, makes a great example of, and I think you can't discount these examples of women who really are doing everything right. You know, they have the ambition, they have the effort, they're doing well, and they're still facing barriers. So I think that I don't think that we can reasonably sort of discount the fact that barriers exist. At the same time, I do think that for many women, especially women who are, let's say, not even going into law or going into finance, or choosing other career paths, it could be that there are, you know, factors like considerations about childbearing, considerations about career family conflicts that are making them make different choices. Now, what that means for policy, though, even if it is, you know, that women are deciding to take a different career path because of challenges of balancing and work and family, that doesn't necessarily mean that the blame and the responsibility all goes on women for not achieving as much, right? I think that that raises this policy question of what are we doing in the workplace? How are we structuring work that we cause women to have these choices, to be forced to make these choices? And maybe what can we do as a society in terms of providing alternatives for childcare and support that could change the shape of those choices? So I think that when we see an outcome, it's sort of the result of all of these different inputs. It's women's choices and it's employers' behavior and it's also, you know, education and stuff that happens earlier. But at the same time, the whole structure of these choices happens within our structure of work and our structure of childcare and society.
Rosalind, you wanted to respond to that.
Yeah, I think one of the things we make a point of in the last chapter of our book is that in order to try to resolve or make this problem better, less difficult, you need a three-pronged approach. The individual women can do things, can advance their own cause. But leaning in and doing more is not going to make the big difference by itself. You need address systemic bias in the company by looking at things that corporations can do. And that could be educating managers to how they may be discriminating when they don't intend to be.
Right. You write about the fact that the same resume with identical attributes, the managers are more likely to call in the male candidate for the job interview than the female.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And, you know, we are nuts in this country when it comes to family-friendly policies. When you look across the world, we're way behind every other civilized country in things like family leave, maternity leave, paternity leave, everything. I mean, some people, you know, in Europe look at us and think, you people are nuts.
But there are also a lot of people in this country who hear that conversation and a flashing red light goes off because they think, oh, what you're doing is advocating policies that will hurt business.
Well, in fact, what we know is that the better women do in business, the better the bottom line. So that this is not just a fairness to women argument. We have to present this on if women do well in your company's going to do well.
There's also a perception challenge, you say, and this is something I've seen too. Women who speak up at work are sometimes called difficult. You've talked about that. Women who are successful are often portrayed as miserable or unhappy and destined to be childless and alone. Does that contribute to holding women back in their own minds?
Absolutely. I mean, if that's the only picture you have of what it means to be successful, then why in the world would you want to do that? When the facts are, and then it's a story that's not being told, that while it is in fact hard for women to get to be a high level or maybe CEO positions in major corporations, there are women who are in those positions, and the large majority of them have families. So this notion that women who have children are, you know, sort of destined to fail or they're never going to make it is just wrong. But we don't, that's not a popular story. We don't have that.
It's a big media narrative. For example, a New York Times story saying that traditional couples have better sex than egalitarian couples.
Not true?
It's bogus. Completely lousy junk science.
Yeah, if I could just jump in, something that I noticed in some of my research on motherhood, the effects of motherhood on women's career outcomes, and motherhood delay in particular, is that actually childless women have lower earnings and lower wages than women who become mothers later in life, let's say in after their mid-30s or early 40s.
Do you have a logic for that? Or not yet?
Well, I think a big part of it, I think that what I try to do in the paper is to try to estimate the sort of causal effect of how did motherhood affect women's careers. But the fact is that motherhood itself is a choice and is related to, you know, different characteristics of women. And so I think that the group of women who end up becoming mothers later in life were basically higher earners before they became mothers.
Interesting.
To begin with. And so a lot of it is just those differences. But even with the penalty, they still end up ahead of this group of childless women.
All right. I'd like to take a call from Buffalo, New York. This is Pano. Pano, hi. Thanks for being with us.
Hi.
Go ahead. What's your comment? Yeah.
So I just have a question. And my question was regards to seeing these pain advanced disparities Are we also seeing these where women are the employers or managers? So essentially, women not only are the victims of this social behavior, but maybe even the perpetrators sometimes?
That's a fabulous question. Basically, are women bosses actually contributing to holding other women back? Rosalind?
Yeah, there's some literature on this. It's called the glass escalator. So in female-dominated occupations, whether it's social work or nursing, men come into these occupations and they find themselves quickly rising to the top. They're being promoted over more senior, more experienced women. And who's doing the promoting but women? And the question is, why is that? Well, there's no particular one answer, but one of them is potentially that women, senior women don't want to be seen biased against men. So they give men a leg up. And they also may be participating unconsciously in the general belief in this culture that men have more leadership ability.
And we see this in the issue of the, you know, not doing as well on teams. It's women that believe that as well. It's women that believe that high-level women are difficult. So these stereotypes are not just male. They're shared by women.
Is there also a fear among women that if you're a woman in leadership, there's only room for one? And if you start promoting other women, you're actually threatened yourself?
That still exists. The queen bee, sure.
The queen bee, you call it. What is that? Explain.
Well, the queen bee is like there's only one queen in the hive, and that's me, and I don't want to share.
Amalia,
sorry, if I could.
Yes.
Yeah, I keep trying to jump in. Well, I've done some research sort of related to this topic in a setting, not a female-dominated setting, but a male-dominated setting, which is sort of the highest levels of corporate hierarchies, some research with David Matza at Northwestern. And what we found is actually – I'm sure that there are women holding other women back, but we did find some evidence that having more women in the hiring position or in the highest position of authority, so in particular, we look at women on corporate boards. So as there are more women on a corporate board, we do find that in the following years, that leads to a greater likelihood of other women being promoted to being one of the top five executives at that same company. And we also find that when there are more women on corporate boards, that leads to a narrowing of the gender pay gap among those top executives. So I think that there are certainly, you know, stories that go in both directions, but I think that there does seem to be evidence that of women helping women in corporate America and of, you know, spillover benefits from having more women in leadership.
So more senior women in turn leads to more senior women. Let's take a call from Racine, Wisconsin. This is Annie. Hi, Annie.
Hi, thanks for covering this topic. You know, it's interesting. My question would be, what is the percentage of HR recruiters that are female? Do we have any data on that?
I don't know of any. Sorry.
I don't know the number, but I think HR is stereotypically female-dominated.
Annie, and what's the point you're trying to make with this information?
In my personal experience, it's been mostly female recruiters, and I think that that's on its face, I think that's great. I wonder, with all the discussion that you've had, I wonder what your guests think about, is it possible, especially what you just talked about before my call, is it possible that HR recruiters that are female could be more critical of other females? And could they be, you know, they're in the sense the gatekeepers for these positions. Do your guests feel that that has any part to play?
Carol, in our last... Sorry to cut you off, Annie. We're running short. But Carol, just a few seconds, are women sometimes our own worst critics?
Yes, we can be. And I think it's not because women are mean to other women, but because they believe the stereotypes. It's down in their gut, and they react on that gut rather than on, you know, what they should be reacting on.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're asking, why aren't there more women in the top jobs, in the corner offices? We're talking now with Carol Rivers, Rosalind Barrett, and Amalia Miller. Carol and Rosalind Barnett, I keep doing it, Barnett, have a new book out called This New Soft War on Women, How the Myth of Female Ascendance is Hurting Women, Men, and Our Economy. Amalia Miller is professor of economics at the University of Virginia. So, Carol, I want to ask you, the name of the book is The New Soft War on Women. Is there really a war going on? And if so, who's waging it?
Well, I think one of the things is there's a soft war because it's not the old in-your-face bias. It's the stereotypes in our heads, and sometimes it's waged by men, sometimes it's waged by women, and sometimes we've met the enemy and she is us.
There's... to review what we've talked about a little bit, we've agreed that women have a slight, a percentage more attendance at university and high-level education than men. And then once they go into the workplace, see page differential almost immediately, a paid wage differential almost immediately. And you're attributing some of that to cultural differences, bias, and some of this subtle war. I want to go to a call from Mary in Boston, and we can talk about it on the other end. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Jessica. I just wanted to first thank your panel for bringing these issues up and discussing this, because for anyone who has a doubt out there, these are real issues. I have experienced every single one of them from the work that I do get credited to my male counterparts every day, to not getting promotion, for taking so much additional responsibility versus my male counterparts getting promotion for getting a fraction of additional responsibilities in the department. So all these issues are very real, down to the bossy word and the B word. In addition to that, when I raised these, I'm not sure if that was covered. I was off.
It's okay. Go ahead.
There for a while is a retaliation. Then there is when you raise those, they start because now you are kind of you're bringing up these issues. Sometimes there is a subtle retaliation that they try to not include you. They
resent you.
They resent
and push you.
Bring up issues that don't exist, and they wear you down by trying to prove no, this is not an issue, or there was no such incident, or so. I don't know if your panel have seen any of that, or what would their advice be?
Okay.
That when do you speak up, and when don't you speak up? And the other thing, that it's a question and observation, is that sometimes I try to analyze and look at it and see what could cause that. One of the things I realized, that women who work hard, who want to get ahead, one of the things we do is we come to work, we focus on work, we work hard, and then we go run to our children and our families and our friends, that we have tighter, it seems, community relationships, to college friends or what have you. Whereas men seem to extend their relationships at work. They go have drink. They go play golf.
They network more. Okay, Mary, I think you brought up a lot for us to discuss. It's great points, and we appreciate you sharing a very personal experience with us. Rosalind, let me start with tackling that this way. I've worked with lovely men who don't mean to be doing anything wrong. Do you believe that what Mary's experiencing is even conscious to the men who are around her?
No. I mean, there may be exceptions, but I think in general, men are doing this because this is what is done. You know, and they don't maybe think that there's anything that they're doing that's wrong. You know, all our messages are one kind. All our cultural icons are one kind. The strong, aggressive, forceful male, the weak, caring, non-emotional, irrational woman.
Well, there are new stereotypes. I mean,
that's a dominant stereotype. That's
Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, there are always exceptions, and that's really what makes the point.
Of course, Hillary's been called the B word something like 700 times.
And survived it.
Well, she didn't win.
You make a point.
Yeah.
Okay. Debatable whether that's why she didn't win, but that's right. A whole other hour discussion. Her latter question was, what advice would you give to women? And I think it's a challenging one, because if you stand up and speak out for yourself, you risk being labeled as difficult. And if you don't, you risk seeing the guy get the credit. So what do you advise,
Rosalind? It's absolutely true. So there's no one silver bullet here. But if women make a case because they have objective data, they keep track of what they've done, they know what their strengths are, and they enter into discussion about promotions or salary, not talking about generalities, but just saying, you know, my task for this year was to do these things. Here's my report. I was asked to do, you know, X of these, and I've done them, and I was asked to do Y of those, and I've checked that off. So you have the conversation about objective facts and not around sort of loosey-goosey, gassy stuff about, you know, trying hard.
Also, you can get allies, including men, to go in to superiors and say, hey, have you seen what, you know, Julie did or Mary did? This is a terrific employee, so it's not necessarily just coming from you, but from others as well.
Let's take a call now. This is John from Gurnee, Illinois. John, hi, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Jessica. How are you, girls?
We're girls today. Thanks.
Ladies, excuse me.
No. Go ahead. Please share your experience.
I was calling, actually. To be honest, I think that my whole life I can remember having some sort of an inherent bias against women in power. I always had felt some sort of resentment. I can think back even to like first grade when the head of the class was a girl, feeling some sort of resentment. And I'm not sure why that is. I don't know if that's something that most men feel. Maybe they don't even realize it, but I went through junior ROTC, and I remember even in that, the women that were above me in power, I felt some sort of a resentment. For whatever reason, it's just easier for me to respect a man in power over a woman.
It's incredibly honest of you to share that with us, and appreciate that you are in touch with that. Thanks for calling, John. Carol, you're nodding vigorously. He's unusual for recognizing it, or this is just...
He is, but I think men are victims of these stereotypes because the male stereotype is you are always in charge. And, you know, you see baseball coaches calling their players girls because girls are weak. So that when a man's in a position of having a woman in power, all those cultural stereotypes can come in and you know, really do a number.
It also creates more pressure on men to be tough all the time and to be a big breadwinners. I mean, there's a flip to this, isn't there?
Okay. Yes, I also think that he was very, very forthcoming how early this starts. He was talking about first grade. My goodness, he's 6 years old. And the messages are already there and they're operating in very young children. We're not, most of us, aware of how early these things get set in and how deep the roots are. It's really hard to shake these things out.
Amalia, if you're still with us, do you see some of these perception differences playing out in the college level and how people choose their field of study?
So I am still here, and I think that those perceptions do play out. I just wanted to come back and kind of link Mary's comments and Mike's and just say that I note that Mike's experience of sort of being so open about his own his own feelings, his bias, is extremely unusual. And it's a challenge for people in Mary's situation or in my experience when I feel that, you know, when you feel that there's some implicit bias in that moment against you, if someone's not in touch with it and you raise it with them, I think that that's not a good strategy. It puts people in the defensive. And so I think that there's a lot of questions and research is being done on this to figure out how do you address these implicit biases. If the bias is explicit, you know, you can pass an anti-discrimination law and then you can't post signs saying, you know, only hiring men. But when the bias is tacit, it's not clear that just raising awareness solves the problem. Sometimes it leads to this negative reaction of sort of retaliation that Mary described.
It's a great... Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just think that that's a real challenge. And that's something that, you know, we don't know the answers to. And it's worth trying to figure out.
It's a great point because, Rosalind, I can tell you I have friends who have personally, women friends who have negotiated for higher salaries and got in with all the data and the research and said, this is what I've done. And they say no. And my friends say, I'm trying to lean in here. Can you help me? And they laugh and say, we appreciate that. You're doing great work. You know, go back to your desk. So what advice do you have?
So just one advice. I think the book has some good advice, and I hope Carol and Rosalyn can mention something. Just one thing I was thinking about from my experience that I found helpful was there was a study that found that women are not as good at advocating for themselves when they're negotiating and they're arguing. But actually, when they advocate for someone else on behalf of another person, like a subordinate, they're actually just as effective as men.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I found that kind of helpful in terms of my own experience of thinking of oftentimes when you're asking for a raise or a promotion, it's not just that you want more for yourself. often you're going, you know, you're saying you're going to serve the organization in the future. It's better for the company, better for the department.
Let me interrupt you there because you feel, I'd love, yeah. That's a great point. And I'd love, Carol, for you to discuss mentorship versus sponsorship. Why do women need more sponsors and what is that?
Women have tons of mentors. They're over-mentors, you know, touchy-feely, nice talk and talk. What they don't have is sponsors. And the sponsors is a senior person who's going to put his or her career on the line for you. And that's the person that really moves you up the ladder. If you just have hand-holding mentors, which is what women tend to have, it basically is nice, but it doesn't do much in the long run.
And explain what, how can you get a sponsor if you don't have one? You want somebody, you're saying, as a woman, who will go in and say, she deserves a raise. And I really think she deserves a raise. And the person on top is able to do that because they're senior. How do you, as a junior woman, encourage that kind of relationship, Rosalind?
It's hard. I think some companies have policies that encourage sponsorship. So if you're a manager, you get some recognition for sponsoring a subordinate. If you're doing it on your own, I think it is hard. And I don't know it's impossible, but it's another burden that women have to bear because men get these more often. You know, men are seen as likely candidates to rise to the top. So people will seek men out to promote their careers, and women, not so much.
That's the big difference between the old and the new discrimination. The old was right in your face. You could sue and you could do stuff. The new discrimination is often so subtle that you kind of say, well, what the heck do I do?
Carol, picking up on what you just said and what we're talking about here, one of the topics you write about in the book is that men sometimes say, I promoted that guy because he reminds me of myself when I was young. And it's not surprising that senior people feel comfortable promoting someone else who is in their own image. So if we have to assume that men will naturally and, you know, understandably be inclined to do that, that means women need to help other women. And it isn't happening, or is it happening often enough? I should make it a question, Carol.
Not often enough, as we're seeing by these low numbers and women in top jobs. And yes, if you've got more senior women, as we've seen with the data on women on boards, then you'll be able to find somebody who can say, you know, you remind me of myself when I was a young woman. And so the more women we move into those positions of sponsorship, the more often that they'll probably choose to sponsor women.
Rosalind?
Yeah, there's some data that suggests that it's not just having a woman in a top position that's going to be important, but having three women is going to be the number that we need to focus on.
I'd like to play something from Sheryl Sandberg. We all know Sheryl Sandberg's name. She is one of the chiefs of Facebook and wrote the book Lean In. She talked to ABC's Rebecca Jarvis last June about some of her own challenges in her own self-perception, despite all her accomplishments and her authorship of this book.
Would you call yourself successful right now?
So I wrote a whole book saying that women need to be comfortable with success. And I still feel uncomfortable calling myself successful.
You can't call yourself successful.
It's the challenge. Well, I have to, because I wrote a book telling women to. And if we're going to change the status quo, we're going to have to get more comfortable, myself included.
Boy, that is powerful. And I can say I can relate. I was the chief White House correspondent at CNN, and people would say, congratulations on your accomplishments. And I'd roll my eyes and say, oh, really? I mean, you know, it's my job. I work hard. I just had to minimize it. And I wonder, how does that impact women's own ability to push for themselves and to advance themselves?
Well, when you think this is the first billionaire and she's having trouble with success,
right.
How much so with women? Because, again, we're told not to promote ourselves. That's not nice and caring and womanly. So it's hard often for us to get into that
It's
situation.
Even unattractive. If you don't act humble and say, oh, it's nothing, you feel less appealing, less interesting.
But there is some data that's pretty interesting. If you attribute your success to something other than your own ability privately and do it publicly, it undermines your confidence that you can succeed the next time. It's really important. You asked about how this affects you going forward. If you want something good happens, if you say, I deserve that because I worked for it, that's very builds your self-esteem and builds your confidence going forward. And otherwise, it doesn't do that at all.
So I hear some people complain that they're tired of hearing about this issue and how it's hard for women. Work is hard for everyone. Get over it, they say. What information would you provide? Why would you argue that everyone should care about how women are doing?
Well, first, we know that women's performance is tied to how well the country does, that the better women do, the better the country does. We also know that women are going to be in the workforce for most of their lives. And also that men are going to benefit. Men want their daughters to succeed, and they want their wives to succeed in terms of their own, economic ability. So everybody's got a stake in women doing well.
Amalia, if we could go to you just for a moment in the last few seconds, what kind of data is there that shows women's advancement is helpful to the economy? Is it there?
Yeah, I think that the book makes the point also that sort of the increase in women's labor force participation just increased the size of the workforce really dramatically in the U.S. and a lot of countries in Europe. And that accounts for a big part of the increase in production. So historically, women's entry has been a huge driver. And as women are more productive and if women are earning more wages as a result of that, that's a big driver of economic growth.
And Rosalind Barnes.
The only men I would mention who also benefit is children. If their mothers do well, boys and girls will do better.
Great
too.
Point. Rosalind, in the last few moments.
We have to get away from thinking this is a zero-sum game. We have to get away from thinking that if women succeed, men are going to fail. That's the wrong scenario. Men and women can both succeed. There's no reason in the world why that can't be the story.
Well, we love that you are leading the way for a lot of people and creating a very provocative discussion. Amalia Miller, professor of economics at the University of Virginia, thank you for joining us. And Carol Rivers and Rosalind Barnett, co-authors of the book The New Soft War on Women, thanks to you so much for being with us. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, school stabbings, Ukrainian consequences, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. I'm Jessica Yellen. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.